Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Jeeves, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
All right. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Welcome to the Voice of Indie, episode number 54. I am your host, Beam Weeks. And with me here in the studio is my co-host, Stephen Jeeves. Good evening, Stephen. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. We're having storms here right now. So if you hear rumbling, it's not my belly growling. It's the sky making noise. And it's really been rumbling for the last couple of minutes here. So I wouldn't be surprised if you hear a little bit coming through the microphone. It's been a stormy day. A friend of mine in Michigan last night had a storm roll through and put a tree in his backyard on the ground. And then this morning it busted a big branch out of another tree and damaged his roof. Yeah. So it's storm time.
We had that here. I spent most of this morning and into the early afternoon picking up branches from both sides of my front yard, even into the backyard where there are no trees. It just blew them off the front trees and into the backyard. I hate picking those things up. And it was hot and muggy today, too, so I about melted out there.
Yeah, well, we've got dozens of 125-foot-tall pine trees in the lakeside of the yard as well. So pine cones. Pine cones are great fun when it's a real windy day and they just put them everywhere. And the woman next door's got one of those metal roofs on her house, so when the pine cones are hitting the roof, it sounds like, all kinds of mess out there. But hey, we got some good news. We've been talking about the book Hello Chattanooga by newscaster, journalist, author, and Renaissance man David Carroll. It is now published, and it is starting to populate. So print editions are showing up at some retailers as of today. Ebook editions will start showing up in a couple of days. So over the next week or so, you can start looking for the 712-page edition of Hello Chattanooga, which we're doing this one a little bit cool. The hardcover has a full color interior with hundreds and hundreds of color photos in there. And then if you want to save a little bit of money and get the softcover edition, it's got black and white photos in order to help keep the cost down. So we've got a wide range there. Hello Chattanooga. It's out there populating. We're excited about it. Get out there, start looking for it. And every time you spot it, share it.
If you're into music, sports, movies, politics, this is the book for you. Anything entertaining, this is a cool book. I had to do the indexing on it, which took a lot of work, but it gave me a bird's eye view throughout this whole book. And those pictures, we're working on the book trailer for it. And so I got to see a bunch of these pictures that I've already seen, but looking at them again, I mean, there's just everything in there from Frank Sinatra and Pat Boone to Motley Crue and Taylor Swift and Elvis Presley and the Beatles and the Who. I mean, just all kinds of really cool stuff in the pictures, little notations about interesting little factoids about, you know, what these people were doing when they were in Chattanooga, like Winston Churchill. He was there and some local media showed up at his hotel room and he chased them off. He was angry. Get off my front porch. I'm not here to talk to you. The guy didn't want anything to do with him, but that's Winston Churchill. So check out this book. Get out there and get this. It was a fun, tedious work doing the indexing, but it's a fun read.
Yeah. And we also have the book Learning About Autism is now out. That's by Karen Ingalls. And it's the story of her friend Carol Tucker and how Carol adopted Justin, special needs child who turned out was autistic and had cerebral palsy, and wound up adopting a second son as well, Joshua. And she tried to find some resources in the community to help her with an autistic son and found resources lacking. So she co-founded a school for autistic children. So it's a book that's the story about a family and one child and a determined mother, but it's also a fantastic book full of resources, information, where to look for stuff, what kinds of things are you entitled to, where can you get that help that you're going to need if you're in a situation where you're trying to raise a special needs child. So that's Learning About Autism. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and all of the different ebook formats from Kobo to Google Play to iTunes to Nook to Kindle. And it's out there everywhere you look. It's for sale. Get your copy now, Learning About Autism by Karen Ingalls.
Yeah, and if you missed last week's show, Karen Ingalls and Carol Tucker were our guests. So get over to the archive and look for episode 53. Operation Arctic Sting, a Mac McDowell mission, is out everywhere now. So get out there wherever you buy your books and grab a copy and read it. Excellent book. And write, leave that review. Always leave,
leave
a review.
That review. That's the third book now in the Mac McDowell Mission series, and author Robert G. Willis-Croft is working on the fourth one now. These are turning out to be a very popular series, so check that out. Also, Robert G. Willis-Croft's series, Daedalus, the Daedalus Files, which makes up all four books, they're actually novellas. They're long, short stories, each of the four stories. Now, the first book, Daedalus, you can get that free in ebook format everywhere. I mean, worldwide, Nook, Kindle, Google Play, whatever format you want. If it's the ebook, you can get it for free with the hope that you'll get hooked. And then go ahead and buy those other three stories that are part of this series. Or go ahead and get the Daedalus Files, which is all four books in one. You can get that in print, hardcover, softcover, and, of course, all the different ebook versions as well. So that's Daedalus. It's hard, kind of hard to argue with a free book, people. Get out there and pick up your copy of Daedalus. Make sure you leave that review and spread the word.
Yeah, free is free. All right, listeners, you want to participate in tonight's show? You can give us a call, and we do have a caller on hold. Caller on hold, don't worry. We're going to get to you here shortly. If you want to participate in tonight's show, here is how you can do so.
Call 516-453-9902 right now with your questions or comments for tonight's guest. Or post a note on Twitter with hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body of the tweet and we'll read it on air. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group on Twitter.
Be there.
Yeah, I think you just stepped on somebody's copyrighted phrase when you said that. In fact, I'm almost sure of it. Okay, people, if you miss any of these great shows, go to our archives. We got three websites that have these episodes on them, freshinkgroup.com, stephengees.com, which is my author website, and beamweeks.com, which is my co-host author website. All three of those websites have a tab called podcasts. I'll bet you can't guess what's under that tab. Get over there and find our old shows, especially like last week's one with Karen Ingalls and Carol Tucker. You can also find us on Spotify. And then the big one, of course, is YouTube. Go to YouTube, search for the Fresh Ink Group channel. Make sure you subscribe to our channel while you are there. We picked up a few more subscribers this past week. We need one more to hit a big magic number, so why don't you be that one if you're not already a subscriber. But at any rate, we've now got 54, 55 episodes over there on YouTube. So get over there and check them out. Make sure you leave a comment, spread the word, share them, and help us build the audience for this podcast. So when it's your turn to be on it, we'll have at least several people out there paying attention.
Yeah, and speaking of subscribing, go over to freshinkgroup.com and scroll to the bottom of the homepage, and you will find a place where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter. This will put you in the know for new releases. It'll each week you'll get a link to this show so you can tune in live and participate if you want. And it'll have short stories in there sometimes and videos, all kinds of cool stuff. So, you know, you want to be in the loop, get over there and subscribe and help us build that up as well.
Right. Now, if you did get today's newsletter, there's a new video in there, too, about our short story contests because we're putting together two more anthologies. Check that out. See what the rules are. Go over to the website. Watch that video. Make sure you share that video with people, too, because we're trying to get these contests going again and get that second and third edition out. Now, our guest tonight is a longtime friend of both of your co-hosts, Susan Hughes. She's a fantastic editor, somebody whose work we have long respected, and we've been wanting to have her on the show for a while, so we're kind of excited about it. Beam's getting ready to read her bio here, but I just want to mention real quick that this is an example where we're going to try to include in the show some useful tips for writers and creators as well, like we did with Trenton Bennett a few weeks back, where he was talking about how to get into producing your own audiobooks. Today, we're going to ask Susan some questions about how to find the right editor and what to look for and what to expect in the editing process. So it should be a very valuable show. And with that, Beam, why don't you tell us who Susan is?
Okay, well, Susan Hughes is a freelance editor and proofreader handling both fiction and nonfiction, as well as corporate publications, essays, and articles. She specializes in substantive editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Susan earned a BA in English Literature from the University of Houston at Clear Lake City and is a member of the Editorial Freelancers Association. Susan and her husband live in Friendswood, Texas, with their three fur babies. They share a love of God, family, friends, good books, and world travel. Welcome to the show, Susan. We are, true, like Stephen just said, we are excited to have you here.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
So you live in Texas now. Is this where you are you originally from Texas? If not, where are you originally from?
Well, I've been here since I was three, so I pretty much consider myself a Texan. I was born in Washington State, but my parents got here as quick as they can, as they could, so I've been here since.
Okay.
So what was it like growing up in Texas from the age three and beyond?
It's hot here.
Huh.
I listen to you guys in your intro talking about storms and rain and wishing some of that was taking place outside my window right now, but it's about 98 degrees and 98% humidity. we're about 30 miles from the coast, so we're in the hot part of Texas, and it's a long summer. We've still got August and September and into October before we usually don't see any cool weather here till about Halloween.
Yeah, author John Howell, he's from down in that area too. Or not from there, but that's where he lives. Yeah, he used to live in, I believe it was Corpus Christi, or maybe it was Galveston.
Okay.
I can't remember. But I know he moved inland
okay.
some time ago.
Just north of Galveston. So, and it's about the same weather as in Corpus. My daughter was down there for a long time.
Okay, shout out to John.
And if you're going to say Corpus, you got to shout out to Larry Landgraf, who's down there in the Guadalupe River Swamp.
Yep.
We've got Robert McKenzie down there. We got Marsha Fox down there.
Yeah.
We've got poet Richard Jenkins. We published his book, Behind the Smile. He's down there. In fact, he owns a water utility in the Houston area.
Oh, wow.
And he's a grandmaster karate guy who got COVID and wound up in the hospital on a ventilator and is really struggling to recover.
So we
want to give a shout out to him and wish him the best. But we do have quite a cluster of authors from that Houston area. So you're in a hotbed of writing down there, Susan.
Yes, there's quite a group of writers in this area. You're right. Although my clients are kind of from all over the place, but that's the nice thing about the internet, I guess, right?
Yeah, one of them anyway.
Yeah.
So were you a reader and writer when you were a kid, or is this something that came along later?
I was a reader. I've always been a reader. I remember one of my fondest memories of my childhood is when the bookmobile would come.
I know I'm dating myself there.
But, yeah. And my mom would drive us to each get two books from the bookmobile. And, of course, we always had library cards, and my parents were big into all that, so... I've always been a reader, and I don't get as much free time to read when I read all day on the computer, of course, you know, but it's still my number one pastime. I love to read. And writing, I've always just been good at it. I know, you know, I'm terrible at math, but English was always my thing, hence the
Oh, that's me.
And, yeah,
you can keep your numbers.
I can't do math. Yep.
You can keep your numbers. Just let me write.
Yeah,
but it's interesting.
So I've been the go-to person when it comes to proofreading, writing letters for people, you know, to the board or whoever. And so I've always kind of been that person. And I did proofreading for my kids when they were in college until one of my daughter's professors wanted to know who the comma queen was, called her the comma queen, and she got a C minus or something on the paper because there were too many unnecessary commas in his opinion. So that was the last time she asked me to proofread a college paper. But anyway,
sure bet he was wrong too.
That's easy for me. So it makes this job fun, and I was a teacher for 29 years, so you know, I was busy doing other things besides writing, and then I kind of fell into this second career, which wasn't really something I was looking for, but it's turned out to be wonderful. So
now, yeah. It's interesting that you said your mother used to drive you to the bookmobile. Back in the early 70s, it used to drive down our street, and it would park right there on our street. Like, I remember several times it parked right out in front of our house, and so all the kids
wow.
in the neighborhood.
Well, ours didn't come down the street. We had to go to it, and it was down like in a central part of town, and you had to drive there.
Yeah, they would come once a month, I think it was, or twice a month or something like that, maybe every 2 weeks. And they would park, and most of the time it was right in front of our house. So we'd have all the neighborhood kids in front of our house, everybody clamoring to get on board and get their books.
That's
too
cool.
Beam, do we still have a caller?
We do. We can take this caller. So let's go ahead and do that. Hello, caller. Welcome to the show. You are on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm Pat Guthrie.
Hi, Pat.
Am
I the caller? Am I the caller?
You're the caller.
You're the caller.
Woo-hoo.
Welcome to the show, Pat Guthrie.
Hi, Pat.
Thank you. Hi. So how are you?
I'm good.
I think you probably answered my main questions is how you got into this business of being an editor. I kind of want to know, were you mainly self-taught, or did you take classes in this?
As far as the editing part goes?
Yeah, as far as being a professional at it.
Well, it's a good question. I fell into this as far as a career when I was asked by a family friend to read his book that he had self-published, and so I did, and it was full of errors, and being an English writer person, that just drove me nuts. I was so distracted by the mistakes that I couldn't get to the story. And so I finished it, and then I told him, you know, hey, I would love to proofread this for you. You know, found a few things, blah, blah, blah. So I did it for him, and he was overwhelmed and said, you should do this. You know, you're good at this. And after I'd retired from teaching, I took a year off, and I was not looking. I was looking for something to do, but I wasn't looking for a full-time job. And lo and behold, I ended up with one. And I did not know. I guess basically it unfolded in front of me. It was one of those things. The opportunities appeared, and I kind of. I was winging it there for a little bit, and then I did a lot of research. I did not take any classes. I've always been able to write and to write sentences that sound good, and as far as putting it together, the composition of it. But I did a whole lot of research, joined some organizations, did some more research, talked to a lot of people, followed on social media, other editors, and immersed myself in it that way and took small jobs. And, you know, word of mouth is by far the best referral. So once I got a few clients built up, then it really made it nice. And I could get some referrals that way. But I've done a wide variety of editing. And so some of it's just been people contacting me and saying, hey, you know, can you fix this paper? Can you help me with a resume? Can you you know, can you proofread this? Mm-hmm. And so it was a learning experience along the way. I've been at it for about 10 years professionally. So I've definitely honed my craft, and there's a lot to learn. It changes very fast. So
I imagine it does. I know writing changes by the hour.
Right. Well, and the rules change. And, you know, if I'm working, one of the very first jobs I had was for Charles Garcia, who was, I don't know what he's doing today because it's been a while, but he's a pretty much a big guy. And he was writing pieces for Fox News Latino. Huh? And so I was using an AP style guide, and so I eventually had to learn AP style guide. I had to learn Chicago Menial style, and then I've had some work with British English, and so then there's a whole nother. Yeah, so yeah, it's a learning experience, and I welcome the challenge. You know, it's fun. I think it's fun. So
that's terrific. I'm so envious of people who can just naturally do that and not have to spend their whole life studying it.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a blessing. And the thing about it is I've had that ability but had nowhere really to use it. My goal, I wanted to teach writing at the high school level, but by the time I got to teaching in the high school, you know, it's all test, everything's test driven and state standards and all that. And there's no composition
mm-hmm.
class like there was when I was in high school. And so that
kind
of got set aside. So I just had to,
I just happened to find something else
and it's worked well for me and I enjoy it. Can't really complain about that. So
I'm taking it you taught English.
Actually, I taught English for a few years, but my minor is history, and so I ended up teaching social studies. Yeah, I taught social studies, but a lot of my work was with at-risk kids, and so they really weren't that interested in the facts. It was not so much the facts as it was teach them survival skill type things, so I got to do a little bit of writing work with them, but public school here in Texas, it's the writing is just not the focus, and I'm really not sure what the focus is, but it's not writing. So
here too, same in Illinois.
Yeah, I think it's just a national issue, but yeah. So I have met some incredible people and have made some good friends and done a lot of repeat work for some clients. And they're very gracious about referring me, and so I've built myself a nice little network of people who, up until COVID hit, were just cranking out books right and left. And then, you know, everybody's a bit distracted right now, so.
Right.
You know.
I agree.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Susan, you, as I read in your bio, you know, you went to college and you just talked about having your degree in English and your minor was history. Did you go to college with the idea of becoming a teacher, or were you kind of open to maybe looking at other things?
No, that's what I wanted to do. I was one of those people who used to play school with my sister, and you know, and I was born a teacher, and that's just what I always wanted to do. And you know, at the time, my parents were both college educated, which was not all that common at the time, you know, to have my mother also have a degree. And going to college was not an option in our family. That was one of those things that's just what you did. That's just what came after high school. And so, I kind of had to pick, and I was very comfortable in that role. And it's really paid off because one of the things that I really enjoy about editing is the ability to teach writers things along the way and not just say, this is wrong, you know. I love the fact that I get to teach whether the clients take it and use it or not depends on the client. But I have been able to watch writers grow from what I've been able to teach them about why certain things don't work and, you know, what makes this sentence sound better. And I do a lot of instructing in my comments when I edit. And I've actually seen writers grow and blossom and develop from book project to project, and that's very fulfilling for me. So I still get to be a teacher even though I'm not in the classroom, and thank God I'm not.
Yeah, once a teacher, always a teacher.
I think so. I'm afraid so, and I do tell my
clients
that.
Well, that's a good thing, though.
Well, I warn them up front, you know, you can take this or leave it. You know, I'm going to show you these things. And I have had a couple of clients who, even just the simplest things, they just want to crank it out and get the book out, and because they know I'm going to fix it. So it's, you know, it's like they don't really care to improve their writing, and that's not as fun for me and as fulfilling for me, but of course I still do the job.
And see right there, that can't be fun and fulfilling for a writer either, because I'm always learning new techniques and new things and adding them to my writing, and that to me is that's the fun part. That's a lot of fun. Trying something different.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll take the job, but I much prefer the ones who spend time with their revisions and come back to me and say, "I see, you know, that really made sense," and or I can see in their in the second read-through, I can really see the improvement, and even better if it is on to the next book, you know, and you can just tell things that they were doing wrong they have fixed, and mechanical things, but then you can see their sentence structure grow, and it's just fun. I love it, and I know my husband says he doesn't see how I sit in front of the computer all day, but it's way less stress than sitting in front of a classroom of 30 freshmen.
Oh, I'll bet, yeah. Well, before we go to Twitter, Patricia, was there anything else you wanted to add for Susan?
No, this is a great conversation. I'm relating to a lot of this. Thank you.
All right, well, feel free.
Feel
free to stick around, Patricia. Stay on if you want.
Okay, I will.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for
so
calling
much.
In, Patricia.
Okay, Susan, thank you.
Now, over on Twitter, earlier we had a comment from Robert G. Williscroft talking about the importance of editing, and he really put this out there and helped us promote this show tonight because he wants to spread the word about Susan Hughes and invite people to come hear what she has to say. We've got a tweet by Helen Burrell, PhD. She says, "I enjoy editing my own fiction and nonfiction, but writer friends are grateful there's an expert editor like Susan Hughes, whose intricate work on their manuscripts saves them from wrangling with tedious aspects of creativity, leading to manuscript excellence." Yeah, how
awesome.
True, Dr. Helen. And then from Wayne Greenhoe, he says, "At Fresh Ink Group, my hometown was small, so we never had a bookmobile." Would you have a book scooter? So I hung out in the school library from second grade on. I became a library helper in third grade and have worked in the library of grade all the way through my 4 years of college. I loved it. All right. Great.
Maybe it
and
was a Robert, book Schwinn.
Yeah. And then Robert G. Williscroft adds, "Do you use the Microsoft editing feature of MS Word with your editing?"
I use track changes, if that's what he's referring to. I use Perfectit. I don't know if he's familiar with that, Perfectit 5, which is a program that I can run my manuscripts through before I start on them, and it does things like pulls up words that may be spelled two different ways in the manuscript. It catches tedious little things before I actually start reading. And that's been a real blessing as well. Track changes in Word is the tool that I use to edit, and that's pretty effective because I like to comment and have the client see what I've done marked right in there for them. So
yeah, I'm like that too. I like when I change something, I like to explain why I changed it. Because
right.
I know a lot of times they're looking at it and thinking, well, he did that wrong. And it's like, well, no, I
right.
need to explain why this one was the exception or something like
right.
that. So those comments make a big difference.
Well, and Perfectit mm-hmm. Has just put out a new, they have, it's Perfectit 5. It's from Intelligent Editing is the source of that. And they have now linked, if you have a subscription to Chicago Manual of Style, to an online subscription, they will link your Perfecta account to your Chicago Manual of Style. And so when you make changes on there, if there's a specific rule from CMOS that you want to refer back to or you want to share with your client, it pops right up there for you.
Oh,
so
nice.
So it's really cool. Yeah, you don't have to go back and forth. You can say, well, as per Chicago number 265.3, and you can put it right out there. And I know a lot of my clients will appreciate that. That's brand new. In fact, I just found that out a couple of days ago.
Good to know.
So. Mm-hmm.
So, Beam, you want to roll a commercial?
I was just thinking that.
Let's do the worldwide premiere of the new Hello Chattanooga radio commercial to be followed by the video, which will be done probably tomorrow.
Hello Chattanooga, famous people who have visited the Tennessee Valley, features photos, stories, and complete listings of the entertainers, athletes, political leaders, and others who visited the area since 1900. Chattanooga has attracted some of the best-known celebrities in the world, thanks to our city's historic venues, beautiful scenery, and powerful people. Hello Chattanooga features hundreds of restored photos, behind-the-scenes stories, and thousands of fully indexed entries spanning more than 700 pages. I'm David Carroll. I've worked in Chattanooga television and radio for more than 40 years. I also write a weekly newspaper column and have written two other books, Chattanooga Radio and Television, A Photo History of Chattanooga Media, and Volunteer Bama Dog, A TV Guy's Love Letter to the South, a collection of my most popular stories. Hello Chattanooga is proudly published by Fresh Ink Group in a keepsake, jacketed, hardcover edition with full-color interior printing, softcover with black and white photos, and all-color ebook formats worldwide. Take a trip back in time, enjoy great memories, and maybe even settle an argument as you learn the dates and places that your favorite star, athlete, or president visited the Chattanooga area.
All right, so get out there and grab a copy of that one. Like we talked about this, at the beginning of the show, just a really cool book. There are some of those, I enjoy most of the books that we publish. I get to see pretty much most of them in some capacity or other. But there are certain ones that just really stand out that are fun. The audio books that we do for Ellie Collins and Robert G. Williscroft, that's a lot of fun. Dr. Helen's book, American Agony, was a lot of fun. The Mark Herndon memoir, The High Road, really a lot of fun. And now, Dr. Helen's wasn't necessarily fun. It was eye-opening. So but it was one of those that still sticks with me to this day. And then you've got this one here, and it's just a really cool read. So get out there and grab a copy of that. Now, Susan, hobbies and interests, when you're not editing, what do you like to do? How do you spend your time? Do you travel? Do you, go out and see the world?
We go off and see the world as much as we can. We have, since my husband was a teacher as well, and after we both retired, we decided traveling was what we wanted to do. And so fortunately, I was blessed to have enough editing work to pay for our travel. So it's kind of funded our little adventures. But we've become particularly fond of Italy, and we've done quite a few European trips. We just like to go. We don't get to go as often as we'd like, but we did just come back in June from a trip to Costa Rica, and that was fun. It was postponed from the summer before because of COVID, but we did get to we pulled that off, and we travel sometimes. We were traveling once a year with our two adult children and their significant others, so there's just six adults, and we went somewhere special every year. That was kind of our thing. We went to Jamaica. We like to rent houses and split the cost three ways. It makes it very affordable, and we actually all kind of get along. So
that helps.
On vacation. Especially on vacation, and when you have somebody fixing rum punches for you, that doesn't hurt either. But we've had some really some really good travels. I have gotten myself all tangled up in animal rescue, and I am a kitten foster mother, and so I'm involved with that a lot. And I also raise butterflies, which is, I think what I did was I took my COVID funk and turned it into pastimes that were kind of renewal, you know, the whole butterfly thing and the little lost kittens and whatever. And I never do anything halfway. It's like I dive right in and make a mess usually. But so I've got two really fun hobbies. My backyard nectar garden is a registered monarch way station by the Monarch Society. And so I have a backyard full of butterflies, and it's really pretty fun. I've enjoyed it.
That's interesting. Some years ago, when I had another blog podcast that I did, I interviewed Harriet Hodgson. She's another writer. She's up in Maine, I believe, and she's somebody involved with the monarch butterflies as well.
She is.
Listen,
I'll have to check her out.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I follow her on Twitter, but I don't think we've talked butterflies. But yeah, it's a friend got me into it, and it's not an expensive habit, and my husband built me a habitat for my little critters, and I love it, and gave me a good excuse to beef up my flower beds and get out there, and had time during COVID to do more yard work. And so,
yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Harriet. I've interviewed a bunch of people over the years, but I'm thinking that it was her. But
you're
the second person that works with monarchs that I've talked to.
Betty Stevens is up there in Maine too.
It might be Betty Stevens.
I think you're right.
Yeah,
I think it is. Betty.
It is. Okay, because I knew it was one of them up there in Maine.
Betty
Stevens.
And there's only a couple of them up there in Maine, so we got to narrow it down.
They all live up there by Stephen King.
Yeah, exactly. Now Susan, you also participate in the melanoma awareness community. There's a personal story there?
Yes, there is a personal story there. As a lot of people, I guess, are not – okay, let me think how to begin this. My dad died of melanoma.
He
was 47 years old, and that was in the 70s. And back in the 70s, no one knew anything about melanoma. Of course, cancer research and all that since then has changed that scene. But he worked with the Atomic Energy Commission, and so he was present at the bomb testings in Nevada in the 50s, and was exposed to a lot of radiation. Who knows if that probably played a part, I would assume. But there is a hereditary aspect to melanoma, and so I'm also very moly and freckly. My dad had lots of moles on his body. I had some too, and so my mom, when I was in high school when he passed, and she had me off to the dermatologist and all these things cut off. And then long story short, I had my first child in 1982, and I took him for his two-week checkup to the pediatrician, and she spied a spot on my neck. And instead of looking at my newborn baby, she's saying, you need to go to the dermatologist. And so that scared me, because the only other person that really ever said anything was my mom. And so I went, and I had stage 1 melanoma. And I can recall everything about the day I got that phone call. And I'm sure it's because of what we went through with my dad that I was aware at the time of that melanoma can kill you. It's not just skin cancer. It invades your organs, and there is no ever getting over it. You're never cured of melanoma because of the seeds that it plants in your body. And so it's been an ongoing battle. Fortunately, mine was very superficial, and I was able to have the wide excision surgery and have that removed, but I was in my 20s, so it was very devastating. And I was a sun worshiper. We had a pool, and I coated up with baby oil and floated around out there every summer, and it was hot, and I sunburned, and I did all the wrong things. But, of course, at the time, we didn't know. So my daughter has also inherited my skin, and she has had numerous precancerous things removed, but she's been very vigilant because I've made her be very vigilant. I'm vigilant for her. And my son as well. I get him to go during May. May is Melanoma Awareness Month, so I'm able to find, there's always free skin cancer screenings all over the country during May for that reason. So I can always get him to go to a freebie one somewhere. He lives in Dallas, so I call him and get him in, but he's been lucky so far. So I've had two bouts with it, both stage one. And my dermatologist tells me that he's seen people with a recurrence 20-plus years after the initial diagnosis. So, you know, they cut it off and they think they've got it, but there's just no telling where it's going to pop back up. You just have to keep an eye on it. So I go regularly for my skin checks, and there's, you know, it's just something that's part of my life. But I started tweeting about it, and I started putting out a lot of automated tweets about melanoma. And so many people reached out to me, and I thought, well, you know what, this is just something that people don't know a lot about. And especially with the advent of tanning bed use and so many young people involved, you know, using tanning beds, and that is like one of the number one causes of skin cancer. And so there are other skin cancers, squamous cell and basal cell, and they're not as invasive. They don't kill you. But melanoma can. It invades your organs. It gets in your blood. And once it does, then the prognosis is not good for late-stage melanoma, although it's getting better.
Hmm.
So, yeah, so that's what I do. And the Melanoma Research Foundation, MRF, is very active on social media, and they had a method by which you could get certified to be a quote-unquote melanoma educator. So I did that and I made 100. I was a proud student. And, you know, so I could stick that up there on my profile or whatever. And I've had a lot of people tell me they went, and some friends as well, tell me they went and because of something that I posted, you know, and so they went and got it checked, and that's a good thing. So whatever I can do to help, you know, increase awareness of it, just because it's not one of those cancers that's talked about, like breast cancer, now colon cancer. You know, there are certain cancers that's just in the news all the time. Melanoma is not one of them.
No.
So I even attracted the attention of Nora McDonald, the CBS anchor, who went through a skin cancer scare of her own, and she reached out to me on social media. So that was kind of cool. But anyway.
Yeah, I've had it dug out of me twice now, too. I have a big divot out of my shoulder. And one of the things that I've noticed is people don't seem to treat it as important. It's like,
no.
Oh, that's just a minor cancer. And it's like, no,
right.
That's the one that can also kill you just as quickly
right.
as some of the others. And a lot of people don't seem to treat it seriously or urgently. And
mm-hmm.
that's the kind of thing you got to be on that, because once it's discovered,
right.
if you can get the margins out and get that cleaned up
right.
quickly,
you're
it's
fine.
Over.
Yeah.
yeah. But, if you wait a year.
Oh, yeah. My doctor told me if I had waited 6 more months, it would have been a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're dealing with, I didn't have to have chemo or any kind of other treatment. But you're right. People just say, well, that's just skin cancer. I can't tell you how often you hear that. It's just skin cancer. It's not
right.
just skin
right.
cancer. You know,
yeah.
it can go guilty
yeah.
in your brain. And then, you know, just like Jimmy Carter's brain tumor was melanoma. It can get in your brain. It can
Bob Marley
yeah.
died from melanoma,
and
it started under
yeah.
his toenail.
Under his toenail.
Wow.
Yes,
he thought it was a bruise.
Yeah, and that's what it looks like.
Playing soccer.
Dark mark or dark line or whatever that doesn't go away, and people don't understand that. Bottoms of your feet, in between your toes, anywhere warm and moist and dark, where the sun don't shine, all those places are hotbeds for melanoma growth. And so, yeah, it's something you have to stay on top of. It's not pleasant to go to the doctor and have them search you from head to toe, but if it keeps you alive, it's certainly worth it. You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Well, we have just raised awareness, so a lot of good
there
was done
go.
Today. And over on Twitter, we got a couple of comments. Robert Willis Croft clarified it was the track changes that he was talking about. He
okay,
says
good.
That he uses Grammarly, which,
okay.
Man,
that's
I hate it when clients of mine using Grammarly because I wind up having to explain all the ways that it was wrong.
Right.
yeah. We got a comment from Susan Hughes, who's using your picture. She thanked Patricia Guthrie for calling in. I think this is the first time, Beam, we've seen our guest participating on Twitter during the show. And then Robert Willis Croft, tongue-in-cheek, he says he understands that the Monarch Society puts out a memo to monarchs twice a year identifying the new stopping spots.
Well, it's working. They read well. So,
yeah.
They definitely come through here on their way to Mexico.
Yeah, the seminar on how to use Google Maps was poorly attended by the monarchs, so they're still doing it the hard way.
I love it.
But thanks
great.
For the comments. Now, Beam, you want to go ahead and roll another commercial, and then we've got some specific questions about editing and the business that we want to get into with Susan. This would be Learning About Autism, Karen Ingalls' book.
All righty.
Learning About Autism, One Mother's Journey of Discovery and Love, a charter school, teaching methods, and resources is the book millions of families must have. Carol Tucker travels the road of autism and cerebral palsy with her adopted son, Justin, now a young man who routinely astounds physicians with his achievements. She is a special education teacher, recognized leader in children's advocacy, and one of the founders of Florida's first charter school for autism, where she served as director. Through photos and stories, best-selling author Karen Ingalls shares Carol's journey, then offers a wealth of resources, teaching methods, school choices, and financial assistance options. With Karen's unique insight, Learning About Autism shows how one very determined mother and her family can rise above daunting challenges to thrive and find happiness. Learning About Autism is published worldwide in jacketed hardcover, softcover, and all ebook editions.
All right. Yeah. And if you, like I said earlier, if you didn't catch last week's episode, get over to the archives and check that out. It was a good conversation and another one that was kind of educational.
Yep. Now, listeners, we're looking for callers. So call 516-453-9902, and you can make a comment or ask a question of my independent editor, Susan Hughes, or get over to Twitter and put hashtag Fresh Ink Group in your tweet, and we'll see it right now while we're on the air.
Okay, so as an author, I need an editor. Where do I find one, Susan?
Well, it's important that you're careful in that search, definitely. There are so many scammers out there. And people who say they're going to provide a service who aren't qualified to do so, which is why I suggest starting with people that you know who are writers who have had an editor, asking friends in your writers group or your critique group or on social media if you're a writer who's involved with writing groups on social media. If you haven't written anything before, get on social media and look. And I think word of mouth, if it's somebody who you know who has used an editor and been happy, then that's probably your safest bet. If you don't have that, then I recommend you go to a professional organization geared toward editing, like the Editorial Freelancers Association, which I belong to. I also belong to ACES, the Society for Copy Editing. And both of those organizations have websites that have directories with editors of all different types of things. And you can use a filter and go through and choose. But it's not a guarantee, but I have had people find me that way. through my profile. And that way at least you're starting somewhere where you know that there's been some sort of connection to the editing world in there rather than just Joe Blow off the street. You know, it's fine to have your Aunt Mary read your paper, read your book, whatever, offer you insight. That kind of critiquing is always valuable. However, that's not editing, and it can make and break you if you don't find the right one. So I've had clients come to me who have already had their book edited, and supposedly, and they paid for editing, and it's still a mess, and they're getting reviews that comment about the editing, the lack of editing, and the, you know, they come to me and say, hey, you know, can you help me? And, of course, I do, but then they're paying twice. So,
yeah, that's not
good.
We're kind of familiar with that issue with Harmony Kent. She's an editor over in England, and she has some stories about having to kind of salvage people's projects from editors who didn't know what they were doing. We do have a caller. You guys want to take another call?
Sure.
All righty. Okay, area code 256. Caller, you are on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hi, this is Barbara Johnson.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's so wonderful to hear another editor speak for first-time writers. I had a wonderful editor at Fresh Ink Group, and I just boast about that person all the time. And Ms. Hughes is right. Once you've had a great experience with a great editor, then you do promote that editor all the time with your friends that are writers as well. And I did like the what she said about being a teacher. I'm an educator also, a former educator, retired educator. And we always teach. And that's one thing I appreciated about my editor is that he was a teacher. And whenever he would send corrections, it was always with an explanation, and I would keep all of those responses so that I wouldn't make the same mistakes again. So I credit my editor at Fresh Ink. He knows who he is with the success of my book, Sassy Discovers the AME Church. It's always great to have a great editor and a great experience with a great editor.
It makes a huge difference. But you are, and a part of it, I'm sure, it's because you're a teacher. You're also a very willing student when you're getting feedback from a wonderful editor who is pointing you in the right direction. You take it and you learn from it because that's what teachers do. And so, yeah, it's definitely makes a huge difference to have somebody that you trust.
Absolutely. I have my notebook. I keep all of my editing notes in the notebook. So I won't make the same mistakes again on my next book. So thank you, Jeez. You're a great editor.
Well, I appreciate that.
Thanks for calling, Barbara. It's great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Hughes. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling, Barbara.
And what Barbara's talking about there is a critical part of that editor relationship, and it's the trust.
Right.
It's once that person has established, okay, I understand what you're trying to do with your book, and I know how to respect it, and take care of it, and help you accomplish your goal without damaging what you have done. Once you get past that hump and you trust your editor, then you're a lot more open to the learning aspect of it as well.
Because
a lot of people start out very defensive when you start picking apart something that they've worked on, and it's like, well, I worked on that sentence all day, and it's like, well, I feel bad for you that you couldn't do better after.
I have a client who I have since edited numerous books for him, but the first one, and he's an excellent writer, Vincent Panettiere is his name, and he's written some wonderful books. But the first time we worked together, he was very incensed that I had as he told me, I quote, butchered his story. And he could not believe that I butchered his story. And it went on and on and on. It was next thing you know, a couple of weeks, you know, of course, I did not apologize for what I did. I apologized that he took it that way, you know, and that was not the intent. That's not the way in which I presented myself, you know, and that it took time, that perhaps he should set the book aside and, you know, let it sit there, take a little bit, let it stew. And next thing you know, I get a delivery of flowers from, he lives in Los Angeles. There's a flower delivery from LA at my house, and a note that his wife had read the email and said he was too mean, and that he should tread a little bit more gently with me. And so he apologized. Now, was this like, we were just getting to know each other. You know, it's like, this is how it's going to be. And he knows that I make suggestions to his writing. He's an excellent writer, so there's not so much fixing to do. But there's, you know, there are just some places where things needed to be adjusted. And he learned that it was all in good faith, and that I wasn't changing his voice, and that maybe if he looked at it at something that I had suggested, that he could come to it from a different direction and say things a little differently, you know, that it would read more smoothly and make more sense. So we have since become friends, and I've gotten some wine and some flowers. At any time I'm particularly rough, he always has to give me his opinion of what I've done, and he comes around and loves it, but he always feels guilty. I think it's his wife. His wife is Penny, and Penny's got my back.
Yeah, you know, you know, the thing is most people may not realize this, but your favorite authors, the ones who write the New York Times bestsellers, they have editors. They have people,
right,
that second pair of eyes that they trust to help make their stories those really good stories. You know, somebody like a Stephen King, he uses an editor. He's not my favorite author, but he's the favorite of a lot of people. He sold a ton of books. But
yeah,
even
quite
he has
a few.
Yeah. Even he has a trusted author that he or editor that he uses.
Editor, right.
And he's a good writer. He's a good storyteller. I'll say that. He's
right.
A good storyteller. And
there's
you know,
a difference,
you know,
in between being a good storyteller,
yes,
and being a good writer.
That's why I made that adjustment. I don't think he's a great writer, but he's a good storyteller.
Yes. So those are two totally different things. Which is why those of us who edit will always have a job, because there's a lot of people
and the
who
pushback,
weave a tail, but they can't get it down cleanly.
The pushback, you know, from some authors, some are just arrogant. I mean, they, what do you mean? And, you know, we've all seen them where they get offended. How dare you? And then there's those that think that they know best and they are clueless. I've run into those.
Yes, me too.
And
or worse,
has,
somebody they trusted has given
G.
a bad info too.
Yeah.
Well, and that's possible too.
And I've seen
Mr.
that a few
G.
times. Oh no, this was already edited. This was already fixed. No.
Yeah. And so who they didn't say anything was wrong with that. I've had that before. Well, no one said that before. No one's marked that before. No one's, you know, and I'm like, well, she's marking it now.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
Something wrong here, and let me explain to you what it is. So
now,
you know,
since we're kind of moving into that direction, what are some of the qualities to look for in an editor?
I think the trust thing is huge, and the problem is that is not something that it takes time to develop that. And so I personally think it's important that you start with somebody who communicates well with you. Because I can't tell you how many people have come to me and said, well, you know, this, you know, I've emailed 10 people and you're the only one that emailed me back promptly. You know, and so, especially when you're vying for business as an editor or when you're looking for an editor, you're handing over your precious baby to them, to someone you don't know. And so building that trust is to me is huge. And so I communicate fast. You know, I tell my people when they ask me this question, look for somebody who will answer you quickly, who will be available, who has a website that you can go to learn more about the person, to see testimonials, to read testimonials from other clients. You know, they need to be somebody that's accessible. And I also think it's very important that they belong to a professional organization, that they're committed to more than just saying they're doing this. I'm an editor. Well, are they actually participating in an organization or two? Are they out there in the real world, or are they just another one of the many that are floating around on social media that you can find that will take your money and not give you quality work?
Yeah.
Someone asked me once, do you think an editor has to have written their own book? And I know many of the people that I work with in the editing business have also written and published. I have published, but I have not published fiction. I have two booklets published. In fact, the Editorial Freelancers Association published my two book, had me write, and then they published two booklets. Those are geared toward people who want to be freelance editors. So I've done that. I am not a creative storyteller. And so I find it much more rewarding to do the editing end and of a story that's already been semi-created or completely created, and then I can pick up and help weave and blend, and I don't have to think of the whole story from A to Z because that's not my thing. So, you know, I have not published a fiction book. Has that stopped me from being a successful editor? No, it has.
Well,
so,
I want to interject a baseball analogy because this is a good point. Sparky Anderson, he was one of the greatest baseball managers ever. And the guy never played in the major leagues. If he did, it was like for 5 or 6 games. He was not a major league caliber player, but he understood the mechanics of the game and became one of the greatest managers ever. 3 World Series titles. And same way with Tommy Lasorda from the Dodgers. This guy was a brilliant baseball mind, but didn't have the mechanics to play the game. But he knew the mechanics,
right,
how to get other people to play it.
Right.
So that's kind of
those are perfect examples. Yeah, analogies are good. Those are good. You know, and they said, well, how can you edit if you haven't written? Well, I can. I know how to, and I know the language. I know how to make it flow. I know about word choice. I know the rules. I know when you can break the rules. Which you can, you know, and I'm an avid reader, so I've read tons and tons and tons and tons of all different genres, and, you know, I know what the story should flow like, even though I haven't written one. So, you know, I have been asked that question before, and, you know, I think the two necessarily have to go hand in hand, but that's my opinion.
So is editing expensive? I mean, is it worth the investment for most authors? What kind of costs should somebody expect if they're looking for an editor?
It is not cheap. And I tell clients, if you think about it, how many years does a writer spend investing their time to get this book written? Years for some of them. You know, it's they're not all cranking them all out like James Patterson. You know, so. Then to expect that you wouldn't invest the same to have it polished is, to me, it doesn't make sense. It's expensive. You can find inexpensive. You can find ridiculously expensive. I am in the middle of the EFA's rate chart, but my prices will fluctuate depending upon the skill level of the writer, the type of project, extraneous things like changing all of the American English to British English. You know, there are different factors involved. If I'm fact-checking, that's a different, you know, too. And I tell my clients, there's no reason why you can't afford an edit because most of us will work with you. I know indie, I work with a lot of indie authors. They're not rolling in money. They know they're not going to, for the most part, probably not going to make a ton of money. But the edit is the biggest investment they have, really. And so, you know, I take payment plans. I take we do installments. I do whatever it takes. I do require that they have to pay me half up front. And I don't give them back anything until they've paid their entire balance. So, but they can spread it out however long they want. And I suggest to people when they first start writing, and start putting some money aside if it's going to, you know, if it's going to be a financial burden.
That's
which
a good
it is
idea.
For many. Mm-hmm. Yeah, start just like you would save some money up to, you know, buy a new computer or whatever it is you're saving money for.
Or to take that vacation.
Take that vacation, that's right. So, you know, and I mean, I can't tell you how long I had to save to go to Costa Rica, but if it's something that really matters to you, then you do it. And I had a client pay me $25 out of her paycheck twice a month until she was done paying. I mean, and if that's what it takes,
takes.
You know, that's what you should do. And you cut corners and you get what you pay for. So, you know, then you're coming back to you, to Steve and to you or to me or to somebody and paying again when you should have found the right person to begin with. So it's just really important. And yes, it's not cheap, but nothing worthwhile is. And skipping that step is, to me, a huge mistake because you only get one shot at making a first impression. I know that's an old cliche thing, but you put a book out there and you get reviews, it's not good. You know, your name is already got three strikes against it before you even start, and there's so many bajillion people publishing. Anybody can be a published writer. Anybody can be you know, I can't tell you. Anybody can be an international bestseller. Just get yourself in a box set and go. You know, it's like.
I've got a Kindle full of books that I couldn't get past the first chapter because of the editing.
Exactly. And, you know, it's just not worth it. If you're serious, you know, I have another friend who just put out a book, and he's not a close personal friend, but he is. We've traveled with him and his wife before, and he did not ask me to edit it, which I'm really glad. But he published it after he retired, and it, from what I've heard, needed to be edited. And he said, "Well, I just wanted to get it out there. You know, I just wanted to say I published a book." Which,
that's
okay, if, you know,
wrong.
If that's all
that's
you're
wrong.
Really trying to do, but that's not what most of the people I work with are doing. They're serious. They want to write. They want someone to notice what they're doing, and they want to be successful. So,
you know, and you hit the nail on the head when you were talking about this. This is their name,
right?
Because these books that I have on my Kindle, I still get people that I've got their book on my Kindle and couldn't get past the first chapter. They're hitting me up on Twitter. Hey, I got a new one. You want to check this one out too? And, you know, I don't because, look, your name has already been tarnished because you just wanted to get it out there and it was not worth being out there. This is, you're putting your name, your reputation, everything
reputation
out there, who you are
in that
book.
Agree
so put out your best.
Right.
That's all the more reason to make sure you find the right editor right from the beginning, too. Like Mark Herndon is a good cautionary tale. He went through a couple of editors who messed with his manuscript and actually were wrecking it. And by the time he brought it to me, the job was kind of unedit. Let's unedit this thing and get it back to the way that he had written it in the first place. And, of course, then we cleaned up some things in the process of doing that. But it was like, oh, no, I never would have said that. Let's take that out. And, he changed this. And what is all of this? And it was really frustrating for him because all of that work he put into it, and then it was damaged, and he was trying to repair something that had been damaged by someone. And boy,
that
was
it wasn't even his fault. He didn't do it.
Right. I trusted the wrong people.
Right. And it's easy to do. And, I mean, there's scammers are very talented in the editing business, all of the self-publishing industry. you know, they're out there. It's terrible. And I think it's great that self-publishing is available. I know many people who have gotten out of contracts. Of course, these aren't big top five publishers that they've been working with. They've been boutique publishers or whatever, but, you know, that they've had to get lawyers to break contracts to get out of scam-type situations, you know, and these people have control, still have control over their intellectual property, and you know, their book is just languishing. So it's, you know, it's, I don't know. And to me, I think it's important that self-publishing authors are respected, and they won't be if people continue to just toss out junk. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's, I guess that's what's been the big problem all along, is that anybody can do it. So, you know, it ruins it for the rest of us. Right.
Beware of the ones who approach you saying, I is an editor. How can I editize your book?
Yeah. Well, I used to get those letters all the time from editing companies offering their services. And generally, I would edit the letter and then send it back to them.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
You know, it's like, are you serious? You're trying to show me how good you are and you're not. But there was one, and I'm even going to use their name. It was called Aardvark. They sent me this letter about, hey, we've got editors on staff, and we looked at one of your books, and it needs some editing. Would you let us do that? And it was one of the worst written letters I've ever seen. So I completely edited their letter and sent it back to them and said, no, thanks, I'm good. About a year later, I got another letter from Aardvark, and it was my edited letter.
They were using
my letter out to solicit business for themselves. But the three models that I see out there, Susan, are pretty much editors who charge by time, which I believe is your model, or who charge by quantity, like by the word or by the page, you know, 2 cents a word or 3 cents, mm-hmm. you know, a word or whatever. And then the third one would be just a flat rate for doing the job, which sometimes at Fresh Ink Group we wind up doing because, you know, we'll just do a package deal for everything that we're doing, and we'll include the editing in there. But are there any pros and cons to any of those approaches other than maybe the time is a little harder to predict what your total cost is going to be?
Well, that's part of the reason why I also offer a free sample, and I think a lot of editors are doing that. You know, I edit 1,000 words of a project for free, so I can get a feel for the writer's ability level. That's the primary reason. What am I going to be getting, you know, and how polished is it already? Of course, you know, if you get a 150,000-word manuscript, 1,000 words isn't going to get you much, but it gives me a chance. It also goes back to that trust thing. I'm able to show them, this is what you're going to get from me, you know. And so I am not a fast editor. I am meticulous, but I am not a crank-it-out kind of editor. I'm slow, and I think that's a good thing if you're not in a hurry.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if, of course, and I have done rush jobs, but I charge extra for that. If there's, and I, you know, I tell clients I prefer they not already have their Amazon freebie, whatever, already set, you know, and their book launch already set and all that before they even started. You know, and I do see that, you know, they've got, well, I've got to have it back by this date because that's not how it works.
No.
And I did start out charging basically by time, by the hour, so much an hour, and I think my website still shows that I charge X amount per hour. But I'm actually more of a by-the-word person at this point. I've evolved there, too, and that needs to be changed. I'm glad you brought that up. That I'm more in the two and a half to 3 cents a word range, which is pretty standard. And, you know, it just depends. I start there. I figure, you know, when I get a project, before I give a quote, and I've done this free sample, if it's not looking like it's going to be something just drastically involved, then I go with that range and I give them a quote and I go from there. I've had other things where we were going to do more back and forth than just the two read-throughs that I usually do, and so I do adjust. So sometimes it's by the project. I just kind of play it by ear and see what the whole big picture is. And that's worked for me. It's not like a real cut and dried. Of course, if it's, especially with full-length manuscripts, now if it's something shorter or it's, I've done some work for some school districts before and I was able to just give a flat quote, you know, so I kind of play it by ear. But I am leaning much more heavily toward the by the word at this point in my career, so.
Well, that does have... That does have the advantage of the clients knowing what the cost is up
right.
front, which,
well,
which matters
I always
to a lot of people.
Do, you know, I, like when I do a sample, of course, 1,000 words, again, that's like only a few pages. But, you know, I do time myself and see how long it's going to take. And if I'm spending 3 hours working on a 1,000-word sample, I know that it's going to take me a whole lot longer than it should. And I charge accordingly, you know, and sometimes I've also quoted a ridiculously high amount and thinking, I really don't want to do this project and this doesn't interest me and this is going to be more work than I feel like doing. And I throw out this humongous number and people have fallen for that. I guess that's not a very good thing to say, but if they're willing to pay me that, I'll do it, you know. If there's... It's part of the perks of being a freelancer. I can pick and choose, but
this will cost you $20 million,
yeah.
Which Bill Gates says, "Oh, okay, here."
Well, I did one last year like that with one of our authors, and it was his first book, and he needed to learn a lot.
Yep.
And so instead of, he wanted to pay me to edit it, and I said, well, how about if you pay me even more, and we'll edit it together. And we got on either Zoom or Skype, and we did 163 hours by the time we were done from page one to the last page in that book. And every line we went through them, and I explained to him, this is what's wrong with this. This is how you do this. This is what the rule is about those commas and whatnot. And by about the middle of the book, he was doing more of the editing than I was, with me just watching and answering uh-huh. questions and making suggestions or whatever. And then by the end of the book, we got to that last chapter. I was sitting back and saying, oh, you see the problem in the next one, don't you? Oh, yeah, I see it. And then I sit here and watch him, you know, make his
yeah.
corrections or changes and maybe sometimes make a suggestion. Hey, here's a different way you can do that too or whatever.
Right.
So that by the time he was done, he's writing his second book now and feels like he doesn't even need me anymore. So
right.
good for him. Good for him. That's what the
exactly.
goal was.
I agree completely.
Now, you're talking about, you know, how much time it's going to take to work on a project. The other big variable in that affects that is what kind of editing are you actually doing? And a lot of people really don't know the difference between copy editing, line editing, developmental editing, seat of the pants editing or whatever. Can you explain quickly for us what kinds of editing editors do?
Sure. I am primarily a line and copy editor, probably leaning more toward copy editing, but let me just throw that out there real quick. There's actually several stages in the process, and most writers are not aware that it's not that there's a method to the madness. And usually by the time I get them, sometimes I have writers who are asking for developmental editing. But that should come very early. But usually by the time I get a book to edit, the writer has skipped that step, probably because they had a story in mind and they threw it out there and they wrote their book and now they just want me to make it pretty. So, you know, it starts with developmental editing if you need that, but not all writers need that, which is basically looking at structural changes. You know, does the story stick together? Is the story a story? You know, does it ebb and flow and meet all the criteria for what a good story is? And I'm a reader, so I can read it, and I can tell you, yeah, this is good. I would read this. This has these issues, whatever. But you can pay for a separate developmental edit. You can also pay for a manuscript critique, and that should be at the very beginning, too, that somebody will tell you, They're not checking your commas and your spelling and all that. They're reading your story and telling you if your story is strong and if not, what kind of things that you might do. Good constructive criticism. Line editing is taking it line by line by line by line, one line at a time, and doing what's necessary to make it flow smoothly, some grammatical consistency stuff, just making sure it all sticks together. As a as an editor, I may do some reorganizing there, some rewriting, shuffle things around. But I kind of usually do a combination of line editing and copy editing, which is I still go line for line, line by line by line, but I also toss in the copy edit part of that, which is the spelling and grammar. You know, I create style sheets for my clients, which is something I knew that I started doing in this past year. Before I provide editing notes with basically all the style guide stuff in it, but I have not specifically had a style guide for each client. So that's something new that I've added. And it, that also involves just doing some rewriting, you know, cleaning it up. I make my rewriting suggestions out in the comments. I don't just take it upon myself to rewrite, but I do offer, I like to write. So I if I have a way of saying something that's not flowing, I write. I'll give them examples. I'll give suggestions. I let my clients use those in their entirety if they want or in part, or even maybe it's just going to spark some new ideas in their minds. And, you know, so I enjoy that. Then the design and formatting part, of course, which is all under the same umbrella. And the proofread comes last. I have people who ask me about proofreading. And... And that comes after, that's the very, very last thing after everything has been done, the book's put together, that's been formatted and all that. So you're looking, you're going from your manuscript critique to developmental, and those kind of go together, just if your story sticks, and then line and copy editing.
Yep.
And wrapping it up with a proofread after. So there's a lot to it. It's not just, oh, here, edit my book. It's like, what do you need me to do? And a lot of clients I find, they come to you, everything's already, they should have already done, you know, the manuscript should have already been evaluated if they were uncertain about, you know, the story. And a lot of them are like, well, can you tell me, is this good? It's like, that's not my job to tell you that it's good. You know,
right.
You know, I want to take the book, the finish, I like to be toward the end of the process. Where you've got the story's in there. If you have questions about it, you've sought out somebody who can do that for you. I can do developmental editing. But that's more time-consuming because then you have to read the whole entire book up front and examine and critique. Sometimes mm-hmm. then it goes back and then they have to fix and then it comes back and you haven't even gotten to the line and copy edit. So...
Yes, a lot of people don't realize, too, that that proofreading, they think that if the manuscript has been proofread, then it's covered. And they don't
right.
understand that when, especially these self-published authors who are doing their own formatting, by the time you do the book design or the layout or whatever you want to call it, there's a lot of proofreading that has to happen at that stage, too. Somebody
oh,
needs
yeah.
to notice that, hey, the first seven chapters have one kind of header. Chapter
exactly.
8 has a different kind of header. I don't know how that happened, but you got to spot those kinds of things too. And,
exactly.
and you can't do that until the book is just about ready to go to print.
Right.
And
right.
that's that last proofread. And it's that one
right.
that, even if it only takes just an hour, just, you know, page by page by page,
right.
just look
sit
at
there
everything.
And flip through on the screen or whatever. Yeah, exactly. You know, and they don't understand a lot of self-publishing writers don't understand that there's formatting. You don't just like, I can't just have it fixed and then you send it off and poof, it's going to be on Amazon. You know, that there is so much detail to that. And I go through and look, I love to hit the little Pilcrow and look at all the marks on the page, you know, and I had a guy recently who never used a tab or he spaced dot, 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 dot for every indention. In a there were no indentions set. It was dot 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 the
yeah.
whole book, and the book was long. And so you know, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is not good.
That's like a return at the end of every line, huh?
Every line had a hard return. Yes.
Wow.
It was Yeah. So, but they don't even, people don't realize that, that that's there, you know, that you can actually check and it's a thing, you know, it's like, well, how do you know? And I'm like, well,
yeah.
let me show you.
I ran into that recently. Well, not real recently, within the last year on a project. And it was, I think this one had to do with, this person was relatively new with the computers and things like that and wasn't
right.
up to speed on that stuff. So, but that took an awful lot of time to clean up. But the project's out there and it's an excellent project.
Okay.
I'll leave it there.
Okay.
I'm not going to call anybody out on the air, but yeah, that's, I've seen some crazy stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're winding down to our last couple of minutes here. We do want to mention for the audience that Susan Hughes can be found at gswriter.com as well. She's one of the members of our G's Writer project over there as one of our experts. So if you're looking for some information about her or want to get a hold of her or whatever, look for her over at gswriter.com. But Susan's website is My Independent Editor. Can you tell us about your website real quick, Susan?
My website is really easy to navigate, and I have a great web guy, Harry Williams is his name, with Moonlighting Teachers. And he has put together a nice, has several pages. It has information, background information about me, and it has a page about my rates. And my favorite page is the portfolio. On that tab, you'll see headshots of all of all of the clients I've had that who have actually published. Once the book is out there, I include them on my website, and you can click on their lovely faces and read their testimonials and find links to their books to purchase them on Amazon or wherever they happen to be. And I really like that page. I was looking at that the other day. It's just I have been very blessed with a wide range of different people. All kinds of writers, lots of different genres, and all of them have been learning, part of my learning, the learning process for me, and I learned something from every one of them, and, you know, it's been, I think having a website that's easy to use, it's very user-friendly. You can also submit a sample via, there's a link there, so anybody who's interested in having a sample edit, can go to my website and click on the Submit a Sample tab, and there's just a very short little form to fill out. You can attach some of your writing, and I'm happy to do a free sample edit to show you writers what editing can do for their to polish up their work. And I think that's an important thing for editors to offer. It gives gives writers an opportunity to see what they're getting for the what kind of bang for their buck. And my website's a good place to start to learn
okay.
more about.
Okay. Right. And the website is myindependenteditor.com. You
yep.
can also find Susan Hughes on Twitter at HughesEdits4U, and that's the digit 4 and the letter U, HughesEdits4U. She's on Facebook as My Independent Editor, and she's on LinkedIn as Susan Hughes. Susan, we appreciated having you on this week. We appreciate
all
the callers and participants.
Asking me. It was fun.
Thanks. Thanks, Susan.
Great.
All right.
Now,
thank
next
you, guys.
Week, next week, we've got
Gabriel.
Is it? It's Gabriel Constance.
Gabriel Constance.
Yes, his first name keeps throwing me. Gabriel Constance, and the week after that, Chattanooga broadcaster David Carroll. We'll see you next time, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Yep. Thanks, Susan.
Thanks.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.